Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. This week's guest is David Little, head of the Department of Photography and New Media at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. David was curator of the Institute's 2012 exhibition of more than 200 images from the history of sports photography, a show that earned rave reviews and received nationwide media attention. The accompanying catalog to the exhibition is titled The Sports Show, Athletics as Image and Spectacle, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2012. If you have an interest in sports photography, I recommend the catalog as a rich collection of striking and intriguing images. There are a number of familiar pictures in the catalog, and we'll talk about a few of those in the interview. But as David explains, he was deliberate in leaving out a number of famous shots. In their place are Andy Warhol's Polaroid portraits of Wayne Gretzky and Pelé, Leni Riefenstahl's photographs from the 1936 Berlin Olympics, and turn-of-the-century images of physical education classes. The catalog documents the history of sports photography, but David also makes an argument that these images reveal how sport has become an entertainment and a spectacle. The photos that we see in the sports pages or the nightly video highlights are part of the show. What David is looking for are those photographs that reveal that the sports show is a show, and that athletes have become image-conscious performers. Here's my interview with curator David Little. This week's guest on New Books in Sports is David Little. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'll start by asking you to say a few words about yourself. You are a curator at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, the head of the Department of Photography and New Media. So could you tell us a bit about your background and what led you into the study of photography?
Sure. My background is really in contemporary art, and I studied at Williams College, got my master's there, my PhD at Duke University, and always loved the idea of working with living artists and the kinds of interactions that you have with living artists. They're incredibly inspiring, and it's fascinating to deal with culture as it's unfolding in real time. But I started out at the Museum of Modern Art, where I was head of academic programs, and then was at the Whitney in education as well, and taught at Duke as well as at Art College in Minneapolis. But I always loved the idea of the museum because you're able to work with or talk with or reach just a wide audience, from kids to retirees. And I really realized that when I was lecturing at MoMA. And then I made a kind of an unusual shift, but not unusual except for perhaps within the kind of traditional trajectory of a career, but moving into photography, because I always found that when I was lecturing, I ended up lecturing on photographs. And I did that at MoMA in particular, and MoMA was the museum that first had a department of photography, so they've had a tremendous impact on the history of photography, and really learned about the history of photography lecturing and studying at MoMA. So it wasn't something that I honestly studied as a graduate student when I was looking at contemporary art, and was fortunate enough to land a really wonderful position here at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts.
David, you write in your book that you're also a lifelong sports fan and a
yeah.
player.
And isn't everyone?
Well, that's the next part of my question, because I would say in the minds of most people, the sports bar and the art gallery are places about as far removed from each other as you can possibly get. So I'll ask, is that actually the case? Do you find that your interest in sports and art are somewhat different spheres, or is there more mixing of the two than the layman would expect?
No, they really are different spheres, and that was one of the reasons why I was really drawn to this particular topic. That being said, there are little pockets of sports aficionados and sports lovers within the art world, and I always seem to try to find them. But there are artists, there are also some academics too who are interested in sports. But I was fascinated with this really great divide. So even with individuals or fans who love sports, they think of that as something extracurricular, for lack of a better term, from their real job, whether it's studying history or being an artist. And I was really wanted to look at ways that we might be able to connect those academic pursuits and the pleasures of sports, because I do think, you know, as this show tries to illustrate through both the images as well as through the text, that sports are, you know, very, very complex and historically important as we look back and think about them.
So following up on that, when you brought the idea of this exhibition on sports photography to the Art Institute's directors and the other curators, what was the response? Did you have to make the case for this show?
You know, I didn't, and that was really a surprise for me, because my director is Kaywin Feldman, a wonderful person, a great art lover, and not a sports fan at all. She graduated from Michigan, and she goes every year to the big Michigan-Notre Dame game, but it's more for the fun and the pleasure of it. But is not a sports fan, and I was in fact very worried about talking to her about the show, or not worried, but just trying to figure out how I might be able to discuss the show in a way that might be appealing to her. And I honestly thought that it was a real long shot that I'd get this show on the books. But as it turns out, I had talked to a few other people in the institution, and sure enough, when I was having a meeting with Kaywin about a completely different topic, she looked at me and she said, "I hear a rumor that you're working on a sports show." And I showed her some images then and there, and she was so excited. She really was so excited and said, "Let's just do it." And I was just really inspired by her enthusiasm. And I think that, again, even though she isn't a sports fan, she really just immediately understood where I was coming from and why I thought this was an important idea, and how sports are really just part of daily ritual and life and culture, but we rarely kind of look at them through a critical lens, especially from the art world and within an art museum context.
Well, let me ask about that, because you present this idea that there hasn't been attention to sports photography in the art world, because there is, you know, really the art world separates itself from what it sees as popular culture. But you do say in your essay that there are very few sports photographs that merit a place in an art museum. I think the term you use is that an original sports photograph is pretty rare. So
exactly.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, just like any field, whether it's sports or even, let's say, entertainment, there are certain kinds of ways that photographs are taken, certain subjects, sort of your stock image that they're looking for. And that happens a great deal in sports. So in order for a work to elevate beyond the sort of the commonplace image of a particular figure or game, there are certain elements that have to be in place. And I think a great example, because I'm speaking in the abstract, and really it's a little bit like pornography, a famous statement, you know it when you see it. And I think that that's the case, for instance, in Avedon's portrait of Lou Alcindor, which we acquired for the museum, and I was so struck by how the trustees, again, who weren't sports fans, understood that this image was a beautiful image and that it was a striking portrait, and they had no idea that it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Lou Alcindor. It wasn't important to them. But what that photograph that Avedon created has is it has this, you know, huge figure, but incredibly elegantly posed mm-hmm. in an urban setting and holding a basketball like it's a grapefruit and so young, and I talk about this in the catalog is that you look at Alcindor at that time. I think he's a junior in high school, and he's about to break all the records in scoring and rebounding in New York. And you look at him, and you see this incredible youthful figure who will become the all-time leading scorer in NBA history. But you can see in his eyes, and you can see in the way that Avedon presents him, this is a young man with incredible desire, and also a young man with tremendous poise. You can see the poise in the way that he holds himself. I mean, mm-hmm. most teenagers who had that kind of body would be slumped and wouldn't appear to be as powerful, but he has this kind of powerful figure. And also you can see, we think of Kareem in terms of this great sky hook, and he had such a kind of an effortless quality about him on the court, but you really see the athlete in mm-hmm. that picture because of the way that his body is proportioned. But all of those subtle elements of image making, can only be kind of created by a great photographer. So that's the case, that we don't need to know that Alcindor is a great basketball player. We don't need to know that he's a sports figure, but it's still a work of art or a portrait. And who knows? I mean, that portrait could have still been one of the most important portraits of all time, even if Alcindor didn't become Alcindor. And I, in fact, in the art world, that is the case, because most people don't really know mm-hmm. of his significance and impact within the world of basketball. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, that was a wonderful photograph. I had never seen that published before. Had it ever been published before?
It has been published before, and I have to say, I really wanted to have that photograph on the cover.
Yeah.
But it's it's very, very difficult to get rights for that picture because of the Avedon Foundation. Yeah, and I had seen that picture. I saw it in New York. I saw MoMA had purchased that photograph, and this is again when I was thinking about the sports show, and I was just trying to figure out what I would do, and I saw that picture, and it was just immediate. Oh God, I not only have to have this in the show, but we have to try to get this for our collection. So I was able to get both, which was really terrific.
Yeah, it had the same effect on me. I find that picture to be mesmerizing, and that there are so many things to read in that photograph. So, but related to that, I want to ask before we turn to the book, I want to ask about the process of bringing together this collection of photographs that you had for the exhibition. And as I was looking at the image list in the back of the catalog, it shows that a number of photographs were in the collections of the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, but you also have prints from the Library of Congress, the Museum of Modern Art, the Getty Museum in L.A., as well as from various private collections. And then in your acknowledgement section, you thank dozens of colleagues at galleries and museums across the country. So I'm interested, how did these conversations go? How did you and your colleagues, so these sports fans tucked within the art world, how did you decide on the photographs to be included in the exhibition?
Well, it was just really a lot of research and detective work, and I started out with the major collections, which are in really Houston. I know that Ann Tucker, who's down there in Houston, did an early sports show. She is really the only other sports show that I could really find, and so I knew that she would have collected a bunch of sports images. And then I knew that Getty had a lot of boxing photographs out there, because there was an interesting story. Sam Wagstaff, who was a curator on the East Coast and ended up, I think he was at the Wadsworth Athenaeum in the East Coast and ended up in California. He's also known as, he was Robert Mapplethorpe's lover, but was a huge collector of sports photographs. And I found this tremendous stash of photographs that he'd collected of boxers, by anonymous pictures, but great boxing photographs that were taken in the 50s and 60s. So I had a whole installation, and you can see those as well in the catalog. And then I then started calling people, but as I mentioned right at the beginning, there aren't a lot of folks who know about sports. And my approach is always, especially in this show, was not to show the photographs that everyone expects. Like, for instance, the Neil Leifer's famous photograph of Ali over Liston is not included in the show or the catalog. So I was trying to talk with different people or look in different places to find pictures, and it was very, very hard, but I just scoured the art world, talked to a lot of galleries who I knew had artists that were interested in sports and had depicted sports, and then, you know, put together the show that way. Went to Notre Dame, which was really, really fun. My first time seeing Touchdown Jesus, which was exciting. And was able to go through. They have a great, again, a great boxing archive. I do think that there could be a whole show done on boxing. Boxing pictures are some of the greatest pictures, I think, sports pictures out there. So it was just a lot of contacts, a lot of research. But in all honesty, I didn't have a lot of fellow photo curators who really know are as sort of crazy about sports as I am. So even with the Getty Archive, I was looking at pictures of Liston that they were saying, or Floyd Patterson that were identified as Muhammad Ali. So I had to do a bit. I was able to do a lot of corrections on their IDs, especially, I mean, not just for the obvious people. I'm not an expert in boxing, but you know, I think for sports fan, you know who the major figures were, or you can identify them. So anyway, so it was a lot. It was so much fun because I was able to really. That's again where we get support. I was able to really travel, and what you find with when you're putting together a show like this is photographs look very different in books and up close and personal. So you know, a lot of times, for instance, newspaper. I spent a lot of time at the New York Times and archives, like the Library of Congress that you mentioned. But those photographs that are used that we may know very well for a publication or a newspaper, when you actually see them for a display, they don't have the same kind of print quality that as a curator you're looking for. So you really have to go out there and find it, and then. Along with print quality, if you get into the aesthetic issues, is a photographer who doesn't understand sports can't necessarily take a really good picture. So it's a tricky thing. I think the most talented photographers are those that understand sports but understand image making. And most times they're either one or the other, and to bring together a kind of critical dimension to sports. It's, you know, very, very similar, I would say, in terms of writing. You know, there are the journalist or someone who you read in the newspaper or in Time magazine or the major magazines, and then there are the great writers like Updike, who brings that talent as a writer to his love of sports, and similar thing happens with photography as well. And so I was really, as I was doing this major search, trying to find those pictures. And I'm hoping that we have. I hope there are other sports shows that are out there. There should be more sports shows that are done, because there's certainly more potential to do many different iterations of an approach to thinking about sports. Mm-hmm.
Well, David, let me ask you about the idea behind the title of the exhibition.
Yes.
So what is the sports show, capital S sports show? What did you mean by that?
I that it's a show. It's really a show and entertainment, and I think that this is, in my essay, what I talk about is how sports started with baseball and boxing as more local, that you attended the game and it was a community endeavor. And that's still the case, one might argue, with minor league baseball or high school baseball or some of the high school sports. But now, because of entertainment and television, particularly the role of television and the incredible money that television brought in the catalog. I don't have the statistics, but I have kind of an outline in my essay about, you know, how we go from first contracts of millions to billions now, and with that there is an effort to make sports into a media spectacle and into a show. And so the show, in summary, is really tracing through images the movement of sports from more community and local to a media spectacle and to try to see how that actually affects the kinds of images that are created. And it just keeps happening over and over again. It'll be fascinating to see what attending a sporting event will be like in another 10 years. So, for instance, during the show, the Dallas Cowboys put in the huge, gigantic screen that was literally, as we know, is becoming part of the game. Remember punters were punting into the screen because it was too low. But the idea of having a simultaneous experience. So I really wanted to foreground that idea of this of sports as a show and not just a competition. And I think that also, the idea of a show and entertainment, it really reflects as well on our culture today.
I want to ask about some particular images that were in the show.
Yep.
And to ask about why you included them, but also why or what you as a scholar of photography, what you see in the images.
Yep.
And so one is this image of Jesse Owens on the medal stand. He's won the gold medal, and there's a German athlete behind him giving the Hitler salute as Owens is saluting the flag. And then you have on the facing page in the catalog the famous photograph of the American sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos giving the Black Power salute at the 1968
right.
Olympics. So I'll ask you about those two images that you have.
Yeah, I just was really really struck in looking at that photograph of Owens, because Owens is wearing a wreath. And he's also holding a plant. I think it's also a reef plant, and he is saluting. And then, as you mentioned, the German behind him is giving the Heil Hitler salute. And if you look at the image of Tommy Smith and John Carlos, they're giving kind of Black Power salute, which looks very, very similar in a way to the Hitler salute. And it's more of a, I'm not saying that they're Nazis or anything like that, but it's more of an aggressive, active protest for the treatment of African Americans. And then in the case of Jesse Owens, who equally could have taken that position, it's a much more kind of respectful salute. And I thought these images were so important in terms of thinking about race in America and the changing role of athletes, in the case of Owens being more integrated, being a little bit more passive, maybe too passive in terms of his relationship to power, and John Carlos and Tommy Smith really capitalizing on this moment and recognizing as well how maybe they were being exploited in the 60s, and I thought it was important visually to try to juxtapose those two images to show this transition that happens. The other major figure that plays a role in the exhibition, and I mention a great deal in the book, is someone like Muhammad Ali, and Ali's tremendous impact in terms of race relations, and using his high profile in sports to move forward ideas about African Americans and religion, and of course we know too his position in terms of war and power. We don't have a picture of Tiger Woods in here or Michael Jordan, but that debate, of course, which is written about a great deal in the press since the 80s, continues, because now it's almost as though we've gone a little bit back to Jesse Owens in some way. And I say this a little bit. There was a piece with O.J. Simpson. It's hard to sort of get into too many of the details, but the main point is that Simpson, Jordan, and Tiger, in their cases, they're not just athletes, they're brands. Mm-hmm. And that they recognize that they're a brand, and they don't, or they want to emphasize their role as brands. So to make a political statement might affect their brand. It might affect their ultimate saleability as athletes and as profit. And that is a, that, you know, that in itself could be a really interesting show to look at race and profit and money. So this is a little bit of a kind of a pointing to this moment in history, two different moments, 30s and the 60s, and we could even bring it up to you know, the present day and see how that shifts, that relationship of race and money and the idea of a brand change.
David, you said at the start when you were talking about putting together the images for the exhibition, you were reluctant to bring in some of the more famous images, such as Ali standing over Sonny Liston. You do have some that are I would say universally identifiable, such as
yes.
Carlos and Smith. And one image that struck me in thinking about you know, as sports fans, we see certain pictures and right away we recognize it. It's familiar to us. But at the same time, something I noted in looking through the catalog is how many of those images, those familiar images, are culturally specific. And I thought of it in particular in that your exhibition includes the famous baseball card showing the portrait of Honus Wagner, the player for the Pittsburgh Pirates back in the early 20th century, and how, you know, for a sports fan in the United States, that picture of Wagner would be almost universally recognizable. Yet if you brought that picture to, say, Australia, it would just produce the shrugging of shoulders, basically. You know, what's
right.
The significance of that? So I want to ask you about that in terms of images that have a reach beyond, you know, Carlos and Smith is recognizable world over as opposed to a Honus Wagner on a baseball card.
No, that's absolutely. And I became more and more aware of that through the show, because sometimes you travel shows to European countries, and as I was looking, I looked at, there are a couple of soccer shows. Soccer is a very, very popular sports topic in the art world in Europe, and that's because soccer is so popular in Europe, and that even happens locally. As I mentioned earlier, I was working on a Minnesota sports show, and I realized halfway through trying to organize that show that I couldn't do it, because I didn't grow up here in Minnesota, and I didn't really know all of the subtleties, all of the shared knowledge that true sports fans here have about sports.
That's interesting. So I, as a native of Minnesota, so that's interesting. In your view, I would be better able to organize an exhibition on Minnesota sports photographs as a non-photography expert than you as the photography expert who's not as familiar with the sporting culture.
Yes, I'm not going to give up my position totally to you, though.
it would have been fun to work with you.
You would know the subjects that we would need to address, some of the figures. Then it would be a matter of us talking about the images. But I did not know the key moments in the history of sports. So, for instance, one of the key moments in the history of Minnesota sports that only Minnesotans would probably know is the famous brawl where Minnesota and Ohio State, it was a nationally televised game, and there was basically a riot that broke out
with
the player. And Dave Winfield actually was involved in that. Right, and their player was, you know, kicked in the gut, and it was really an embarrassment to the university. And anyway, but that unless you were here, you might not know about that particular episode. So there's that very, very specific. And I think all of us, you know, wherever we grew up, I mean, I can tell you about growing up in Providence, the famous basketball game during the blizzard of 1976, where Providence College beat North Carolina, which was number one, or something like that. So there are all these like little mini stories that are, you know, have great pride. But it's specific. Sports is specific locally, it's specific nationally, and then, as you pointed out, it's also different countries as well. It becomes has its own little stories, and it's about that personal relationship that we have to those things. But I was always looking at those images that tried to transcend those borders, at least in the United States. It really is mostly a U.S. show, even though it has some European figures in the exhibition. But it's really a U.S. show. But in the case of Wagner, Honus Wagner, the other aspect of Wagner is, marketing and branding. That is one of the most rare cards, and it's debated as to why the card was pulled, but I can't remember the exact number. I think there's estimated to be around 50, and maybe they know that there are 15 in existence of that card, and probably about 3 to 5 that are really in good conditions. But anyway, the reason why they stopped producing that card is apparently Wagner was offended by the fact that the card was sold in cigarette packages. And so it's kind of interesting on a number of levels. I think on the first level that he didn't like cigarette smoking that early on and didn't want to encourage children to smoke on that. That's one level. And I think the other level, in terms of power and branding, is that he was able to stop its production. And we see that today in sports. If Derek Jeter says that he doesn't want something done, or maybe a better case is if Tiger Woods says he wants this or that, he can actually get what he wants. Whereas if you're a 2-bit player and you all of a sudden say to management, you don't want your card, I can't remember the punter here in Minnesota who was very politically active, but was then released. I mean, he was really taking some risk because he wasn't that high powered a player. No one will listen. So, Wagner also understood the power of his role as a cultural icon to stop production of that card.
David, I want to ask about a set of photographs. I was less familiar with. I remember them from back in the 80s, but it was interesting to see them. And these are Andy Warhol's photographs that he did in the early 80s of different sports celebrities. And the ones that struck me in particular were the photographs of Wayne Gretzky, and it looks like it's from the early 80s when he was just starting his career with the Edmonton Oilers.
No, absolutely. And Warhol took a number of Polaroid photographs with the old SX-70s, which were our instant photographs, and he took them of Nicholas and of Ali and of Chris Everett and Martina, and I was really drawn to this set of Wayne Gretzky's, not just because this is what my hair looked like in the 1980s when I had hair. I think what all of our hair looked like, parted in the middle and the feather cut and the mullet, of course. But, Warhol just has a different kind of approach to portraiture as an artist. This is, again, where he's an artist, and he's recognizing Gretzky maybe not as a player. Remember, I was talking earlier about the recognition of having an understanding of sports and having an understanding of art. But what Warhol understands is he understands what it's like to be a star. Mm-hmm. So he is taking a photograph of Gretzky as a star. And there's a great picture where you don't even see Gretzky's face. You just see the blade of the stick, and you see his number. But that's all you need to see, and you know exactly who it is. And then there's a beautiful composition there. But there's this other image that is very well lit, where he's looking directly at you. And there is this, in his portrayals, he's not... same thing, and there's a series of pictures of Nicholas. He shows Nicholas in these very, what we might find as awkward poses. And that's also what I was really attracted to. Gretzky, for instance, looks incredibly vulnerable. He looks rather frightened, or he doesn't look heroic in these pictures. He looks like a young, handsome guy, and even maybe a little bit androgynous as you look at this picture more and more, with the haircut and just the softness of his features here.
Yeah, and he doesn't look like what we would expect of a hockey player, in that with the feathered hair and the tan, and as you said, these vulnerable eyes. He has this androgynous look to him. He's just kind of the specimen of beauty, not
right. Right, and he doesn't have his shoulder pads on. I mean, he's a skinny guy. He's a little guy, and you wouldn't look at this photograph of Gretzky and say, oh, that's the great one.
Yeah.
I mean, you would never think that at all. And there is this kind of throwaway quality of the Polaroid as well. It was really one of the first pictures that had, or productions of a kind of photograph that had that instantaneous image, but also this kind of just, you remember as kids, you pass around the Polaroids after you've taken them, which was so much fun.
David, can I ask you to give us a brief lesson in reading photographs? So when we open the sports page or a magazine like Sports Illustrated, what should we look for in the sense of what makes a good photograph, an original photograph, as a piece of art?
You know, I always say look for something different. I know that sounds really obscure, but one of the ways where you'll find something really different is first of all to start to recognize photographs that are the same. So you could do this when you go home today and look at your Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated is a great example of a set of photographs. And there was, for instance, just the annual football, the preview of football, and you think about the problem of an editor of trying to put together those pictures. So I flipped through it and I thought, okay, let's take a quarterback. What kinds of pictures can you take of a quarterback that shows he is a quarterback? And when you think about that, you're very limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
You have a lot of times the quarterback has the ball in his hand and he's looking upfield as though he's going to pass, or he's got his arm back, like the Statue of Liberty play, he's got his arm back to throw, and with running backs it's the same. So look at those particular patterns in photographs of particular players. Another example is a receiver is usually diving for a ball, or has the ball is just about to come into his gut. Or in baseball, the outfielder is usually jumping to get the catch or jumping in front. So those are so once you develop an understanding of those photographs, all of a sudden there'll be a photograph of a quarterback, and you look at it and you say, that's interesting. I've never seen that picture. It's those pictures that have either it could be outside the frame of the photograph of the quarterback, something that's going in the background. It could be the way that it's composed. It could be an expression. It could be the way that even the quarterback is holding his hands or his arms or his shoulders. There's something in that picture that just all of a sudden kind of pops out at you. And I think the way that one can develop that particular skill, and this is as a curator, is I just look at millions of pictures. So, most pictures, when you're looking at the pictures, honestly, it just takes me a few minutes to look at the picture. And I know, okay, I've seen that picture. And then looking, and then all of a sudden you'll see, oh, okay, this is very, 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 very good. It's just like, I know you teach, and I we shouldn't tell students this, but you can pretty much read the first page.
I can read the first two sentences and know where. Yep.
first page and stuff. So it's that kind of visual that you do. It's when you're house hunting, you go online and you look at like two pictures. You already know what the house is going to be like, and you did make a decision. So anyway, so in looking, trying to make a determination of what is a great photograph, I think first of all you have to really gain an appreciation or an understanding of what is a basic photograph. And then from the basic, then you can look at those attributes. And then as you start to then collect, then you gather those photographs that you think are above the basic, and then you start refining and refining and refining. And what's fascinating is photography sometimes gets a really bad name. I mean, the idea is that, anyone can take a photograph. There's no doubt anyone can take a photograph. And what's amazing to me is that when you see great photographers, they hit it over and over again. They just know how to take pictures. They know how to look through the lens and frame an image or focus on a certain aspect of a movement and give us something that is unexpected or a surprise. I mean, my last... the last thing to think about, this is maybe too, maybe not too esoteric, but too hard to explain, but there's a great critic by the name of Roland Barthes who has written a book called Camera Lucida, and he talks about what he calls as he calls it the punctum, and he says that great photographs have something in the picture that just seems to shoot out of the picture and puncture you. Like it has this effect of an almost an aha moment, and he identifies maybe I'm stealing this a little bit from him, but he does identify a certain oddity, a certain thing in a picture that kind of draws your attention. I mean, my big criticism, and I don't think Sports Illustrated is going to like me very much, but I didn't include any Sports Illustrated photographs.
I noticed that.
There's
yes.
a kind of, they have a style. They have a style mm-hmm. of picture that they take. And once you become familiar with that style of photograph, it's the same photograph over and over again. Now, I have noticed lately they have this section up front of pictures that they've been doing, and they've mm-hmm. gotten a little bit better, and they're trying to be a little bit more creative. But you know, they're really trying to reach a particular kind of audience. So there are certain the male figures. There are a lot of really macho figures, and then also, you know, if there's a picture of a woman tennis player, you can guarantee that it's going to be a picture of her bending over and her underwear showing. You know, that's the Sports Illustrated representations of females in Sports Illustrated. So they're really playing to a certain kind of audience in their pictures, and they're spectacular images too, but. If you think of the sports show, the images that I show in the catalog reveal the show. They have a critical element that says, this is a picture, but we're at a distance and we're able to see the show. Sports Illustrated is part of the show. I think that's the main difference.
So I'll ask you a question, David. We're almost out of time, and I'll ask you a question that comes out of my reading of Sports Illustrated, and in an issue just a couple of weeks ago, there was a photo in the front, one of these new photos that you were talking about, a photo in the front, double page spread, showing the baseball player Ichiro Suzuki. He had just hit his 4,000th hit of his professional career. He was bowing to the crowd at Yankee Stadium, and in the background, you could see everybody in the stands was taking a picture of Ichiro at that moment. And I want to ask you, you know, we live in an age in which cameras and photographs are ubiquitous. So from your perspective as a scholar of photography, will photographs lose the power to move us as we increasingly live our lives looking through a camera? Or, and as you say, you look at millions of pictures, will the distinct photographs, the ones that cause us to have these aha moments, will they stand out even more now that we're surrounded in images?
Yeah, I think I don't know if they'll stand out more, but they'll still stand out. I think that we'll still go through that process of filtering out those great images. It's becoming harder and harder because there are more cameras, but there aren't more great images. But you have to look through more images. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You just have to look through more images. I imagine that editors at Random House and the publications are thinking the same thing, because it's easy to write a novel now, but it doesn't mean that there are more novels with more great novels. So I do think that the power that we will still have those distinctive, powerful images. But I think you also raise another issue, as well as just the ubiquity of photographs and how that might affect, again, the way that we think about and engage in sports. And I one of the things that I noted in the catalog is the way that viewing has changed as a result of media and how we're in the game, and that the camera in particular has offered something that sports really adores and depends on now, is that the camera now determines the winner and loser of games, whether it's the instant replay or you know, in the Michael Phelps case of a camera underneath the water that was able to determine that he touched the wall first, or we saw it 2 weeks ago, which was a very, very interesting case, and I wish there were more discussion about it, but the I don't know if you remember the Tiger Woods case. I guess it was in last week, where Tiger was in the woods, and there was a camera, a long lens camera that was fixed on his ball, and he went to move the leaf. I mean, you just see his hand go down. It's a very, very abstract image, and the ball moves, and he received a two-stroke penalty because of that action. And it's about him always. He complained just last week saying, well, I'm always under the camera, the guys at the camera. They're, what about all the other guys that are in the woods that aren't having a picture? He wasn't making an excuse for himself. He still disputed that the camera, that the ball moved. But this idea of constantly being watched and how that will affect the evaluation. But I think the part of the story that was missed a bit in terms of the Tiger Woods case is when you magnify an image like that, you know, what is movement? Mm-hmm. You know, so the movement of the ball, Tiger said it oscillated. They did determine that the determination was moved. But how do you make a determination of movement and oscillation when you've got such a large-scale image that we're seeing something that isn't natural? I mean, we're pretending that we're seeing something as though we would see it with our own eyes or as Tiger saw it, but we're not. We're seeing it through a high-powered lens, magnified, and in slow motion. So the whole reception of what we see, and you see that, I don't know about you, but I feel that as well when you see something in on a football field when someone fumbles a ball or they lose a ball. Watching something via a camera, there's not a greater truth in some cases. It's a different truth because of what the camera captures. So anyway, it's cameras are fascinating, and it's great to have a camera culture now. For me it is, given my position, because I think the photography, which had always been criticized for being populist, now the very power of photography is because it's populist.
Well, David, thank you for coming on the podcast. This was a wonderful, wonderful book to look through. So, you know, many familiar images, and which I wish I would have been able to see in an exhibition on display, as well as many images that I didn't know of. And I'll ask you to conclude. Did you is the sports show going on the road? Has it been at other museums?
It is not on the road. I'm disappointed we couldn't get it on the road. It was we put this together really, really quickly and couldn't unfortunately get it on the road. But I'm hoping that someone else will do a sports show. And I have to say that the reception for the show has been tremendous. Time Magazine did a long article on the show, and you're calling me a year afterwards, and I've had so many calls about the sports show. I mean, there's just a great desire to sort of think about the subject, and I'm delighted to be part of this history.
You've been listening to an interview with David Little about his exhibition catalog, The Sports Show: Athletics as Image and Spectacle, published in 2012 by the University of Minnesota Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels, podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from sociology to science and technology. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.